with Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Stephen Vincent. We're going to be talking about his book, In the Red Zone. Mr. Vincent, thank you so much for being with us. There we are. Mr. Vincent, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and now, of course, it's a fascinating book, because you actually set out on your own to go into Iraq. And, of course, you paint a beautiful picture. In fact, you write not simply a discourse of what happened, but almost a poetic description of the tragic situation that you found there, the people of Iraq today. Would that be a fair analysis?
I hope so, because that's certainly how I felt.
And, of course, you were in Baghdad, you were in Basra, you traveled all over there, and that was really rather a dangerous thing to do, wasn't it?
You know, I didn't really think of that. Now it would be impossible. What I did, I should tell your listeners, I was there in the I was there in the fall of 2003 and the winter and spring of 2004. To do now what I did then would be suicidal.
I really think it would be as well. Certainly they're taking people, anybody they can catch, and holding them hostage or beheading them. And but anyway, why don't you sort of paint the picture of what you experienced? Of course, you're first going to Baghdad, and this is the fall of 2003, and the American forces are there. And there are some suicide bombings, a few bombings, but certainly there's no great armed organized resistance in Baghdad itself, is there?
No, there wasn't. What there was in the fall of 2003, the regime had collapsed, and the criminal element was running amok in Baghdad. Kidnapping and carjacking, mostly Iraqi people. They weren't really harming foreigners at the time, but there were car bombs going off, and every night you heard gunfire and explosions and saw explosions, and there were quite a few car bombs. I came close in that fall to being caught up in a couple, but that's pretty standard for living in Baghdad.
And, of course, you paint the picture of the people who live there, some who are very appreciative of America, some who hate America. But the impression that I get is that things are really chaotic. They're not regular electricity. There are problems with simply all the normal things that you would have in any civilized society. At least under Saddam, they had electricity. What about water? Was water available all the time in your city in Baghdad?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Iraq that I was surprised to find out is that in all of its history, Iraq has never suffered from famine or shortage of water. It's one of the few Middle Eastern countries that actually has water from the Tigris, the famous Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Bottled water, food was plentiful. The only problem some Iraqis had was in interior plumbing, if they used an electrical system to bring the water up to, say, their fifth floor apartment. When the electricity went out, of course, they had to lug the water up by hand.
But, of course, why was there a shortage of electricity? Certainly they had electricity before the attack. So why was there a problem after the attack with the electricity? And why did it seem that in some ways the whole infrastructure of society seems to have broken down once, of course, we had occupied the country?
Well, the infrastructure was broken down. I don't think the United States understood how the embargo had rotted away the infrastructure. Of course, this was a country where Saddam Hussein pocketed, it looks now like, at least $21 billion during the embargo period.
Hold that thought. We're going to have to bring some of our stations on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Vincent, who is a freelance journalist. Of course, he's written on art. He has written, of course, extensively for National Review and other magazines. But he's written a book published by Spence. Publishers called In the Red Zone. And, of course, in Baghdad today, there is the Green Zone, and that is where the Americans live. There's a part of the city that's fenced off, and it has cortina wire around it and guards. And it's fairly secure in there other than occasional mortar attacks. But then, of course, the rest of the area, outside the enclave, heavily guarded, is the Red Zone, where the Iraqi people live. And there's really a great deal of uncertainty there as far as... Probably even more so now than there was when you were there, do you think?
Well, there's always uncertainty. In ways, things are a little more certain. They have a government. Elections are scheduled. It looks like the Shia are more organized than they were before. So some things have certainly come apart. The situation in the Sunni Triangle, for example, is much worse than when I was there. But on the other hand, the situation with the Shia Muslims is better than when I was there.
Now, where is Fallujah? Is that Sunni or is that Shia?
Fallujah is Sunni, and that's part of the Sunni Triangle, which extends northwest from about 100 miles northwest of Baghdad.
All right. Now, of course, you got down into the Shia area as well. So
yeah.
What was your impression of the Shia area? Was that fairly impoverished? Was that coming about? Was there a peace and stability there? And what about now? Is there peace and stability there now?
Well, let me take your last question first. There seems to be peace and stability there now. It's very complicated, but I guess for your listeners, I can cut to the quick by saying Iraq is divided religiously between the Shia and the Sunnis, and there are a little bit of Christians, but it's mostly the Shia and the Sunnis.
Well, what about the Kurds now? They're really a separate area up the north.
Well, they're Sunni.
Oh, they are, okay.
They're Sunni. They're not Arabs, so
right.
that's an ethnic difference. But as far as religion goes, you basically got the Sunni and the Shia. There are, of the two, Shia comprise about 60% of the Iraqi population. So when elections come, they will probably and almost certainly dominate the government. So the Shia have been playing a game where, aside from Muqtadar al-Sadr, who was this renegade Shia cleric who decided he was going to cause some trouble, they've been following their Ayatollah, Husseini al-Sistani.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, Dr. Stan back here, our guest this afternoon, Stephen Vincent, his book In the Red Zone, and we were just talking about the Shia area. Now, that's the southern area of Iraq, where, of course, the Shias live, and he was saying that, of course, most of the Shias there, overall, they're going along with their leaders, religious leaders, looking towards the coming elections in January, because the Shias make up 60% of the population. All they need to do is have one election. And, of course, it may be like it is in Africa, one man, one vote, one time. Of course, that's what we have to avoid, because if it is purely a democracy, why you will have the Shias in control and lording it over the Sunnis, who have, of course, oppressed the Shia Muslims for such a long period of time. So pick up the story now. You were saying that the people in the south have more or less been following the leadership of their Ayatollah,
right,
who has told them simply to go along with this because things are going to be great once
right.
we get the elections.
Right. They remember that in 1920 they tried to revolt against the British, and the British put down the Shia, and they said, fine, you guys are going to revolt, we'll just give all the power to the Sunnis. Now, the Sunnis make up a minority in Iraq, and they've run the show since 1920. And Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. And he gave all the Sunnis all the preferential jobs in government, money, any kind of benefit you can think of. When the Shia revolted against Saddam after Gulf War I, Saddam cracked down unmercifully on them and cut them off from all sorts of government funding and finances and infrastructure repair. So when you go to a city like Basra, which used to be a beautiful city, it's a trash heap.
Now, was this after the first Gulf War you're speaking of?
Because Saddam cut the Shia off from all sorts of government funding. So not only were the Shia kept out of the government, now they didn't have money for their their own cities and towns. So to get to your question about impoverishment, yes, in the south you find the Shia are much more impoverished.
But now why did the Shia rise up against Saddam at the end of the Gulf War? Wasn't it because an American president told them to and said that if they would rise up, we would come in and help them?
That falls out of the purview of my expertise.
All right, okay, fine.
Truth. But that's what, let me put it this way. That's what the Shia told me.
All right, fine. So that this is what they believe, that they believe that...
Well, they believe even more than that. You have to remember, I'm sure you know, that the Arabs are particularly given to conspiracy theories, and I was told by many people that not only did the United States encourage them to rise up, but they actually helped Saddam put the Shia down.
All right. In other words, they allowed Saddam to use his helicopter gunships and go down and machine gun them by the tens of thousands.
Right. So that's one reason why the Shia have an ambiguous attitude toward us.
All right. So, well, they should certainly know what happens in there, or do you think that they are mistaken?
I'm sorry, your question?
No. Well, if they were living there at the time, they should certainly know what happened. In other words, if they believe the American government told them to rise up, you don't think that that happened, or do you think that did happen?
Oh, you got to remember, these are the same people that told me that the Americans or the Mossad flew the planes into the World Trade Center.
Okay,
that
so you
the
think
Americans helped the Iraqi criminals loot the museum and private homes. I mean, they'll believe anything if it's negative against the United States.
So there is a tremendous animosity towards America then in the Sunni area? Than the Shia area?
No, I wouldn't go that far. This is a very subtle thing, and these are the kind of issues I grappled with in my book. I want to get at exactly the mindset of these people and get under their skin. The Shia have some issues, but not to the point. Let me put it this way. Everybody, every Shia person has a gun. Every wedding night, just gunfire, and they shoot their guns off all the time. If they really wanted to get rid of the coalition forces, either the British down in Basra or the Americans in Baghdad, there'd be nothing the coalition could do. There's so many guns. So they have the Shia now, have their issues with the coalition, but not to the point where they're going to take up arms, largely because they know it's not within their interest. And I heard that again and again and again, and we have a lot to thank Ayatollah Sistani for this.
And do you think this is because they're playing a waiting game until the elections when they think that they will then come out on top?
Yes, absolutely. Now, when they come out on top, what's going to happen after that is an open question. But to take up the issue of the Shia's attitude, that now the Sunni, conversely, are facing not only the loss of their past power, but loss of future power, plus domination by the Shia and the Arab. Now, people told me all the time that Islam is one. You know, Dar al-Islam, House of Islam is one. The Sunni and the Shia are one. And, of course, there are people that intermarry and they're friends and that. But when you really probe down beneath the surface, the Sunni and the Shia do not like each other. The Sunni in particular think the Shia are irrational and crazy. And they dread the fact that the Shia are going to be the dominant force in Iraq. So that's one reason why they've taken up arms. There are other reasons.
All right. Now, what's going to happen to the Christians, though? Of course, if you go into some sort of a theocratic government over there, I understand many of the Christians are fleeing for their lives.
That is difficult. Now, I had a very good Christian friend, a woman named Rand. I actually write about her. And I attended, when I was, I got an apartment in Baghdad, and I attended some churches on Sundays, and those churches were bombed. After I left, because the foreign jihadists are trying to get rid of the Christians, and they're very, very afraid. Down in Basra now, I talk about this, Christian liquor salesmen were being assassinated by religious parties, by Islamic religious parties, and those Christians were telling me that they want to leave. So there's a pressure, and I felt it was mostly from foreigners, not from the Iraqi people themselves. You know, the Sunnis may be killing Americans, but I really felt that the ones that were killing the Christians were from outside the country.
Well, now, of course, as I read your book, you feel that we have to bring democracy to the Middle East, that this is the only alternative we have, that there's a lot of injustice in the Muslim society, certainly women are held down, and that we should come in and impose our style of democracy on them. Would that be a fair statement?
No, not at all. I mean, I do agree that women are oppressed, but I don't believe this idea of bringing democracy to the point of a gun, nor do I think that's what we're doing, because that leaves out the Iraqis. The Iraqis want democracy. What we're doing is allowing them to construct their own democracy. We're not bringing in anything that they don't already want.
I see that the average Iraqi really believes in democracy. Does he understand the philosophy, the history of democracy? Does he understand anything other than he'd like to be free? But does he really understand what's happened down through the centuries with democracies?
No, and that's a difficult issue, but it's also a very tangled issue. In my book, in the last chapter, I go in length my relationship with an Iraqi woman in Basra named Noor. I can't give her last name because she would be in danger from the Islamic parties down there. But she was a moderate Islamic woman, and she was a fervent believer in democracy. And, you know, many was the evening where we would end our day. I went around with her all through Basra. She acted as my translator and friend and protector. Many was the day we ended our work sitting at twilight in a cafe where I would be teaching her about the Constitution, about the Electoral College, about freedom of the press, about the, you know, a division of powers, things that she would just be so amazed and wanted to hear more and more. And she had this idea that all Americans were like this. We all knew about democracy, and I didn't want to disabuse her of the idea of how apathetic our own country is. But she was desperate to learn about this.
Well, of course, our system of government is a unique one, but of course, we are a republic, not a democracy.
Right.
We have a government by law. We have a limitation of government power. We have a division of powers, but this is not the democracy that exists in most places in the world.
Yeah, but the Iraqis, this is something that is of real interest. People say it'll never work. Iraq is made up of too many different kinds of people. It was cobbled together by Winston Churchill after World War I. Well, the very fact that Iraq has Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Arab, Christians is good, because that's where democracy comes from. It's people sitting down and compromising, and this idea of a republic is natural, because the Kurds, for instance, the Kurds don't want to be dominated by the Shia either. But they're not going to fight the Shia. What they're looking for is a federal system like we have.
All right, but are we going to get a federal system there? Certainly, are we even going to get elections in January? We're hearing that some of the clerics over there are saying, after the invasion of Fallujah, don't participate in the election. Of course, that would be suicidal for the Shiites not to do that, because that would give the Sunnis, you know, a power. But
apparently, the other way around, the Sunni, it would be suicidal for the Sunnis not to go to the conference table.
Oh, it's the Sunnis are being told not to.
Right. Now, this is my chapter on the so-called resistance. I talk a lot about the problems with the Sunnis. They look at their again, the Arab Sunnis. The Kurds are completely different. They are so pro-American. When I was up in Kirkuk, they would tell me, everybody's house has a picture of George Bush, and that George Bush is our father. One man told me, if I was a rich man, I would give $1 million a day to help George Bush get reelected. They love America there.
I know. That's true. It's entirely different between the Kurds and the Sunni area and the Shia area. Wouldn't that be a fair statement?
Well, no. It's the difference between the Kurd Sunnis and the Arab Sunnis.
All right, fine.
I know it's complicated. It took me months to figure this out. But the Arab Sunnis in the Sunni Triangle, these are the people, Fallujah, Ramadi, these are the people killing our soldiers. I was in Fallujah. I was in Ramadi. I, as I write in the book, I talk to these people. I ask them, what is it that bothers you so much? And they would give me a whole list of crimes that the United States has done. But then I would ask them, what do you want? The United States leaves. What do you want? and no one ever had an answer.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with our guest today. His name is Stephen Vincent. His book is The Red Zone, and as you read it through, you almost feel that you're there. You almost feel that you can smell the smells he smelled and see the things he did and feel the desperation of many of the people. A society that's really in crisis today, hoping for a better future. I wonder if it's going to come. We'll be right back in just a moment to explore more of what Stephen learned as he traveled by himself throughout Iraq. A very important book is called AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic. Actually, it's a book I wrote back in 1991 that tells you the story of the politics of the AIDS epidemic and the fact that doctors have been blocked at every turn from doing what was really necessary to stop the spread of this horrible plague, both in the United States and throughout the world. AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, it gives you my story of my effort working with an organized medicine. The fact that the doctors of the state of California consistently voted and supported an effective public health policy, and at every turn their efforts were frustrated by those working with an organized medicine, both at the state and national level, and the tragedy is that people are dying in America today unnecessarily. Call 1-800-5-HIV-1 and ask for AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, because you need to understand the background of this epidemic to understand what is really happening medically in America today.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. A secret of healthy aging was recently found among people who have lived unusually long, healthy lives. The longest-lived woman, Jean Calment of France, who lived 122 years, and man, Antonio Todd of the Italian Isle of Sardinia, who lived 115 years, as well as the Queen Mother of England, who lived 100 years, outliving one of her daughters by 3 decades, was their daily consumption of red wine. But health authorities have been reticent to recommend an alcoholic beverage to the public at large until now. Longevinex is the world's first stabilized French red wine extract in a pill, without the calories and without the alcohol or sulfite preservatives. One Longevinex capsule provides the red wine molecules found in 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Tieri. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done. Get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. The guest today is Stephen Vincent. His book, the In the Red Zone, a journey into the soul of Iraq. And it really is a journey into the soul of Iraq from the cab drivers who were so grateful for what America had done that they wouldn't accept the money that you offered them to those who were so bitter and blamed all the problems of Iraq on America. And it's just trying to get an idea of how these people feel. And of course, the tragic situation that they're in today. Of course, they were a terrible situation under Saddam Hussein, a ruthless and tyrannical regime. But of course, didn't some people feel that at least they had stability then? What was your take on that? Because you seem to have a whole spectrum of various approaches of the people you met as to the American invasion.
Well, I can only say this, that a woman who ran a women's health clinic named Hannah Edward told me, under Saddam we had security. But what kind of security was it? The security of the grave. And most of the, almost, yeah, I would, 80-85% of the Iraqis I spoke to, even some of those in the Sunni triangle, were so thankful that Saddam was gone.
Well, I think everybody, of course, recognized he was a terrible, evil individual. So, but then, of course, where do we go now? What's going to happen? How long is America going to stay there? And you commented a number of people that said, well, now that you've got rid of Saddam, why don't you leave and let us set things up on their own? And yet, of course, if America were to leave, there'd even be more chaos.
That's right. And the Iraqi people, I went into this quite a bit in the book. They're humiliated that America had to free them from Saddam. You know, imagine if you were living under an oppressive government, if America was, and a foreign power had to come and finally eliminate the government. We'd be thankful the bad guys were gone, but we would be humiliated, and we would project that humiliation out onto our liberators and have a very ambiguous relationship toward them. So they would say, now go. You've taken care of the problem, now go. Because they were so humiliated, but realistically, it's not possible.
In other words, how do they feel, though? I mean, you and I know that if we pull out of there, there would be total chaos. But did a lot of Iraqis say, go now, leave us alone?
Well, this is what I mean. They said that, but what if they meant it? I'm not always sure. And secondly, they may have meant it, but it may just simply have been unrealistic. The Iraqi people, one of the things that kind of shocked me, didn't always have, I thought, a realistic assessment of their situation.
But do you think people ordinarily do have a realistic assessment? Do you think that even the American people have a realistic assessment of all the intricacies of what goes on in our society today?
Well, it's not so much the intricacies within the society, but yeah, I think we have a realistic assessment of where our country is going because of the press, democracy, the ability to discuss the issues. The Iraqis have none of those. They don't have those kind of institutions where you... There's no press. There's no press they trust. So what they trust instead is gossip. And there's no... the government is not accountable. So there's no real way of challenging their view. So what takes its place is rumor, gossip, whatever the tribal chief says, whatever the imam at the mosque says.
But, of course, isn't this the real problem? You have this tribal situation, then you have your religious, and you call them sort of Islamo-fascists,
yeah.
These people who would control everything through the religious organizations?
Yes, I felt that Islam is a major problem, at least as it's constituted in Iraq. And when it gets mixed in with tribal customs and traditions, it's an extremely dangerous, volatile, combustible, and oppressive ideology.
Well, of course, you know, one of my concerns, it would be, that I don't know if you ever read the book, The Class of Civilizations by Samuel Huntington, professor of history at Harvard, but he talks about, the worst thing we could do would be to try to go to Iraq and impose our views on them. I mean, try to disrupt them in the religious structure of their society, try to force American values on an entirely different culture. Do you think we can really do that? Can we force our
ways on? Again, I don't think that's what we're trying to do. I agree with Huntington, but I disagree with people who say that we're doing that. I think that we're allowing the Iraqis to bring their values to the front. front.
Well, but certainly they're going to change the whole relationship of women. I think it's terrible the way women are treated in the Muslim world, but I really want to get into that when we get back, because you bring this out so beautifully that, you know, the oppression of women is part and parcel of the Muslim faith, and of course it is unjust, totally unjust, and yet we seem to be intent upon trying to use our force to change. Anyway, I really want to get your view on the oppression of women, because I know you've gone into that in great detail. And we're going to be back in just a moment with Stephen Vincent, the author of In the Red Zone, a man who went to Iraq to try to understand what was going on there, and paints a beautiful and vivid picture of a tragic land in transition. Have you ever wondered about the boys we left behind in Vietnam and Korea? Did you ever know that we left 25,000 American boys behind in Russia, in Siberia, at the end of the Second World War? Have you ever wondered what really happened in Oklahoma City, what really happened with the TWA 800 on the Winter Room off the eastern coast of Oregon? Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of the subjects are now covered in a fascinating book by Craig Roberts, entitled The Medusa File. Call 1-800-5-HIV-LOR, order The Medusa File. Actually, Craig Roberts was a police officer working with the Oklahoma City bombing. And this book has been suppressed very effectively across America, and it's self-published, but I promise you that there's no other book in the world that will give you a more contemporary history, frightening history that every American needs to know. Call 1-800-5-HIV-LOR now. Is the best fudge in the world. They've discovered a secret recipe, and it allowed them to actually make the creamiest and most delicious fudge you're going to find anywhere. They also have a sugar-free type of fudge that has a great creamy taste and yet is safe for diabetics. The fudge is made daily, and there are over 30 to 40 different flavors in the store every single day. Midwest Fudge makes a perfect gift for any occasion and makes even a better treat for you. It's shipped out daily, so you're always guaranteed the freshest fudge. So why not place your order by calling 866-526-5419. That's 866-526-5419. Or visit their website at www.worldfamousfudge.com. That's worldfamousfudge.com. Your order will be shipped out the next day. And, of course, they're open 7 days a week. Why don't you stop by and visit them there from 9 in the morning until 9 in the evening.
Leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Vincent, who really has been to Iraq twice since the invasion, and of course since the ouster of Saddam Hussein. And one of the big problems in this Muslim country is really the second-rate status of women there. And of course, but what's the solution? Because this is so wrapped up with the whole Muslim faith.
Well, your point about we impose our values on another society. Let's unpack that for a moment. What I'm arguing is that we're really allowing the Iraqis to develop their own values. And what I'm going to say, I want to preface the idea of women with this point first. There's nothing more Western than Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was really imposing Western values through tyranny and the Ba'ath Party. was modeled after the Nazi Party. So in eliminating the Ba'ath Party, we really are stripping away a great deal of Western attempts to form Iraq into a Western country. Hopefully it will define its own values and cultural mores and institutions. But when it comes to women, I say, yes, we are. I think we should impose Western values. And if it takes out a point of a gun, then it's going to have to be that way. In the same way that eventually we had to say to the South, the Confederacy, no, you cannot have slaves. It is not right. And I believe the situation of women in Iraq, and I would extend it to the Arab Muslim countries, if not Islam in general, is intolerable. I was just shocked, and I don't understand why the Western world just doesn't stand up en masse and say enough.
And in other words, you think that we should simply say to all of the Islamic countries, we will not tolerate this oppression of women.
Yes. I mean, we're not going to invade your country because you exonerate men who kill their daughters or their wives out of honor killings, or we're not going to invade your country because you won't let women go to doctors without the permission of men or drive cars, or that you allow temporary marriages like the Shia do, which is just another way of having a religiously sanctioned adultery. No. But why is it that the left in this country, the feminists, why are they so silent? Why are all the calls for women's freedom in the Muslim world coming from the Christians from the political right? I think the whole spectrum of the West, the political West, should unite on this. And it can only help the Arab Muslim countries. They would tell me themselves, the progressive Iraqis would say, 60%, because the women make up 60% of Iraq because of the losses in war. So many men have died in Saddam's wars. The Iraqi people would tell me 60% of our culture is being wasted. All those talents of those women. So yeah, I think that feminism, as I write in the book, it's the Achilles heel of Islam. It's right where we should be putting all of our... If we want to turn this religion around and this culture around, that's where we should be aiming.
But can't we... I would ask... my thought would be, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that the only way to turn the culture around is to turn the religion around, and it is the religion that condones that, whereas Christianity traditionally has given women equal rights, and it is the Muslim faith that oppresses the women.
Well, this is one thing I'm very proud of in my book and in my travels of Iraq is I got a very good working knowledge of Islam and especially of Shiism. And I write about this extensively. And, you know, I disguised myself as a Shia pilgrim and prayed in the Mosque of Ali. And I was at the Shia's their main religious festival called Ashura at the city of Karbala. I talked to many clerics, and always I brought up the women's issue. And what I found, Dr. Stan, and this is very complicated, but Islam is what you make it. It doesn't have the institutional, or I would say even the symbolic structures of Christianity that form a kind of ideology or a hierarchy. If you're a Catholic, what the Pope says is pretty much the doctrine of the Church. The Protestants have their churches that lay out a doctrine. Especially in Islam, but especially with the Sunnis, it's what your local cleric says. So if your local cleric, you know, your neighborhood mosque imam suddenly decides that men and women can mingle together during a service, well then I suppose they can. But most don't. It's all up really to the individual imam. So the change Islam, I don't think you need to go into the rewrite the Quran, but more the leaders, the Islamic leaders themselves have to take a more progressive attitude.
But how are you going to get them to take a progressive attitude? I mean, these people have a vested interest in preserving things as they are. I mean, their power comes because they are the religious leaders. Change the religion, they lose their power. And would this apply to the Shia clerics as well as the Sunni? Or is it?
It would. The reason I singled out the Sunnis is because they have a very decentralized religion. So you get... That's why you'll find, aside from Muqtadar al-Sadr, who was that renegade Shia cleric in Najaf, and that was leading a short uprising, aside from him, the Shia are pretty organized. When you find a really radical imam, like the Hamdi Masri in Finsbury Park Mosque, who had one arm and one eye and was preaching hatred and said that the Columbia space shuttle was a sign from Allah, the space shuttle disaster, because the crew had an American, an Israeli, and a Hindu on it, and so Allah destroyed the space shuttle. those kind of preachings are almost always going to come from Sunni imams because they have no organization. So to change the religion, you've got to change the thinking of the imams. Now with the Shia, they're organized out of something called the Hauza, and I don't want to bore your listeners with a whole bunch of intra-Shia religious discussion, but they have an organization. They have a slight doctrine, and you need to get in there with moderate Shia clerics, and eventually they can change the Shia thinking.
No, of course. No, how are you ever going to do that? We're going to have to set up schools. Are we going to set up schools for the clerics? And what about, of course, Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, pushing this radical form of Wahhabism and financing it throughout the world? How are we going to stop them from pushing their Wahhabi faith?
Let's take a historical analogy to put this discussion into an understandable context, because there's just so many themes. Again, I look at the South, the Confederacy. The North had a relatively quick, I mean, it took 4 years, but to take over an entire country, the North was victorious in a relatively short period of time, 4 years, militarily. But it took 100 years, socially and culturally and psychologically, to really bring the South and the North together. And, you know, in our living lifetime, there was still white-only drinking fountains and the lunch counter situation and all that. So it takes a long time for people's attitudes to change, but they do change. Just like in the South with enslaved people, it had to change. And I maintain that the situation with women is so intolerable, it's so psychologically unsustainable, that it has to change. But it will take an evolution.
Well, of course, if it's going to, it took 100 years to get the South, when we have both the North and the South with the same religious beliefs and are united in a common nation,
right.
How long are we going to have our troops in the Middle East to bring about the changes that you envision?
Well, it depends on how long we have to, you know, we've had our troops in Germany for, you know, since 50 years.
We've had our troops in Germany and in Japan for 50 years, and I don't think we had any business having our troops in Germany and Japan for 50 years. Do you think that was justified for us to continue dominating those nations for that long a time?
I don't know. I just write about Iraq, Dr. Mann.
What do you think about Iraq? Good. What about Iraq?
And Chris, well, my point in bringing up Japan and Germany was that It's one thing to have troops in a country that you're not fighting. You know, if they're sitting on their bases and they're doing on exercises and intermarrying with the local people and supporting the local economies, well, that's one thing. If you've got troops in a country and they're being car bombed and sniped at and we're losing, you know, 10, 12 a week, that's another thing. I think we'll probably have American presence in the Middle East and in Iraq for a long time. You know, hopefully, inshallah, as the Iraqis would say, the Americans can sit on their bases and not be in the, you know, it'll be peaceful.
I think that the Iraqis will tolerate having Americans there for 50 years?
I don't know about 50 years, but yeah, I do think they'll tolerate them for a few years if they see that. And here's the point I really wanted to write this book, and this is what the Iraqis want to see. You know, they understand why America's there. They understand the necessity for it. The Sunnis are a little off the charts, or a little radicalized about this, but your basic Iraqi, especially the Kurds, knows why the Americans are there. They know they're going to be there for a while. What they want to see is progress. And they want to see progress, and they want to make sure that the United States is serious about what it's doing. And this is the thing that really haunts the Iraqi people. When the looting took place in Baghdad, and America did not stop it immediately, it put out a message, and it set the whole reconstruction of Iraq on a bad footing, that the Americans were not serious.
But of course, when we got in there and we dissolved the army and we dissolved the police force and we fired everybody who, had belonged to the Baathist Party and the people who ran the electric, and the people who worked in the sanitation, we destroyed the whole infrastructure of the
society. No, we didn't destroy it. It was already destroyed. But, disbanding the army, I'm not sure was the wrong thing to do. Or I can put it, let's put it this way. At the time, I can certainly see the logic because the way that governments are overturned aren't by people who are running around and driving car bombs and killing 2, 3, 10 people at a time. Governments are overturned by armies that launch coups. And by disbanding the army, we remove the threat of a pro-Saddam general amassing, 200,000-300,000 troops and launching a coup. So I think at the time I could see the thinking of Bremer and the CPA, and I'm not sure it was not a bad idea. In retrospect, it provided more foot soldiers for the insurgency, but at the time we didn't realize how deep the Sunni resentment toward America was going to go.
But don't you think they should have had some idea before they went in there how they were going to get out? In other words, shouldn't they have some idea how they were going to control that country after they went in?
Yeah. I don't want to exonerate the Bush administration from a manifold mistakes. I think that the Bush administration did many things wrong.
And I think Colin Powell had opposed the going in because he had said, if you break it, you're going to have to fix it.
Well, this is why I agree with Colin Powell, but I also agreed with Bush that I really felt strongly and still do about the necessity for liberating and reconstructing Iraq.
Well, do you think we may have to be there, for 5 years, 10 years, 50 years?
I wouldn't put a time frame on it. It's really up to the Iraqi people, which is, to me, we always see this situation through an America-centric prism, which is, I guess, natural. We're Americans. I wanted to write a book that really, where you try to see things through the Iraq, well, you have to see it through my point of view because I wrote the book, but I wanted to see things through the Iraqi prism, and it's really up to them.
And of course, I think you did a good job of presenting every general point of view. I mean, those were very resentful. Those were very, very grateful. But of course, how do you think that this new situation in Fallujah and, of course, the increasing violence across the country is going to play out? Is this going to make people more grateful to America? Is this going to create more animosity?
Let's look at Fallujah.
All
right. I think it's going to be very interesting. And, your listeners, if they care about this, I think they should really pay attention to Fallujah. Because Fallujah went from being a pro-Saddam city. It's always been a criminal den. It's always been a thieves' center. But it went from a pro-Saddam city. It was then taken by the Americans. The Americans decided that, well, we aren't going to be the bad guys. We're going to let the Iraqis run Fallujah. Well, what happened was Fallujah fell into the hands of Islamo-fascists. Suddenly, liquor couldn't be drunk. Women had to wear a hijab. If you criticized the government, criticized Islam or broke Islamic law, you were whipped publicly in the streets. Now the Americans have re-liberated Fallujah, and we're going to pour $70 million, supposedly, into the makeup of the city. Now, the people in Fallujah have seen life from all sides. They've seen it under Saddam. They've seen it under America, they've seen it under an Islamo-fascist regime, and now they're seeing it back under America. If they don't decide to support the American liberation, then I will be very surprised and very disappointed and probably very unnerved.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. And, I don't have a solution. I wish I had a solution. And, of course, please understand, I'm asking probing questions to get your response.
Sure.
I don't know what the solution is over there.
But, Dr. Stan, I got to say, I remember seeing a national, remember Saturday Evening Post, that magazine?
Oh, yes, I remember it very, very well.
Yeah. From 1946, there was a cover of, Norman Rockwell, the painting and all that. One of the main articles was the occupation of Germany, how the United States lost it. So, when history unfolds, it's very confusing. People thought that, Saturday Evening Post writers thought that we had lost the occupation of Germany after World War II, which, of course, turned out to be false. The people in the South, right after the Civil War, the South had its insurgency, the Ku Klux Klan, the Knight Riders. They had their bandits and insurgents, and eventually they were put down. So as we live through history, things are very confusing. But I have a lot of hope because, and I'm not being idealistic, it's very practical. The Iraqi people know that they have gone through everything, pan-Arabism, pan-nationalism, Saddam, fascism, all that. They only have democracy left. This is their one chance.
Well, of course, you know, they've been occupied by, you know, by the British immediately after the First World War,
right.
And then, of course, they put together this makeshift country with three different sects in it. Instead of having three different countries, they brought them all together, and one is being constantly played against the other, and they go
but
from
but
dictator to
dictator.
That's
what democracy is. Dr. Stan, that's what democracy is, and I think that that's the strength of Iraq. When you have all these various, I mean, look at, I live in New York City. California, look at California where you're from. All the different people that make up our polity. That's how democracy works. And I think Iraq stands a better chance of arising as a democracy because it is so broken, because no one group can really dominate.
All right, fine. Well, we're just about out of time. How can people get copies of your book? And, of course, where are they available?
Well, inshallah, they'll be available at your local bookstore. You can get them through Spence Publishing. If you go to Spence, S-P-E-N-C-E Publishing.com, you can order books, and they tell me they're half off.
The telephone number is 1-888-773-6782. That's 1-888-773-6782, or 1-888-SPENCE-PUB, S-P-E-N-P-U-B. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating subject. I hope you're right. I hope that things do turn out well there. But anyway, thank you so very much for being our guest this afternoon and for really risking your life and going over there to come back with a story of a lot of human interest. It really is a fascinating book.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. I appreciate it.
God bless you. Bye-bye. We have a brand new video today on the Oklahoma City bombing. It's called Oklahoma, What Really Happened. And of course, it consists of a lot of never-before-seen video footage. Now, it was seen in Oklahoma City immediately following the bombing of the Moore Building, but broke out across America. And in this footage, you're going to see the commentators talking about the other bombs that were in the building at the time of the initial bombing. We're told, of course, that Timothy McVeigh acted independently. We're told many things by the media, but wherein does the truth lie? Oklahoma City, What Really Happened, it will give you the opportunity to see long-suppressed video footage of what really transpired. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for Oklahoma City, What Really Happened. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we, of course, have two excellent four-tape sets on Oklahoma City, and then, of course, we have the videos we talked about, Oklahoma City, cover-up in Oklahoma City, and, of course, one of the fascinating things is if you get the video, you'll actually see the film footage that we showed in Oklahoma City on the day of the attack and the day after the attack, talking about the second and third and fourth bombs, and, of course, if you get to our four-tape sets on Oklahoma City, you will actually hear, for instance, the interview with a lawyer who defended a woman who had infiltrated a terrorist group for the government, for the BATF, and she had found out that they were going to attack the Murrah Building, and she had told the BATF, and instead of just going after the terrorists, they went after her. Her name was Carol Howe, and I have the only interview I know of with Clark Brewster, her attorney, going into the background of how he was able to get her off. The government was going to send an innocent woman to prison to keep the American people from knowing that they knew about the Oklahoma City bombing beforehand. And, of course, any of you who heard me talk about this in the book, Others Unknown, the Oklahoma City bombing, by Stephen Jones, he will tell you that he opened the defense of Timothy McVeigh by pointing out that Timothy McVeigh had written to his sister and said, I am working for a secret special forces unit involved in criminal activity. Now, and his sister actually got up and read that. And, you know, not a word of that all across America. And then, of course, there were, of course, other people involved. There were, of course, John Doe 1 and John Doe 2 and John Doe 3, and they were all Iraqis, but they couldn't let the American people know that. Any more they could know that they were planning on attacking us back in 1988. We have a wonderful video. It's called Jihad in America. You need to get that and see it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Let me just mention one of the most significant things we offer to you today is something called Jihad in America. It's a video that was put out in 1994 by Stephen Emerson. And in that video, you'll actually see the head of Al-Qaeda, who at that time was a man named Abdullah Azzam, in 1988. This was before bin Laden took control. In fact, there was a serious question whether bin Laden killed Abdullah Azzam in 1989. But here in 1988, Abdullah Azzam is talking, this is a video of him talking and speaking at a mosque in Oklahoma City. And these films are being shot by the FBI because they're monitoring all of the things that are going on. They monitored the whole Islamic terrorist movement. They knew exactly who these people were and where they were and what they were doing. Their films, of course, of them talking at the mosque in 1989. Their films of the this Islamic terrorist cell from New York City was involved in the first World Trade Center bombing, and of course the murder of Rabbi Kahana, and of course they have them up at a training camp, a Muslim terrorist training camp in upstate New York in 1989. Now, they couldn't let the American people know that, so when the film was released in 1994, why orders were put out, it was not to be shown on American television, and that's how they do it. I mean, they're powerful enough, they can keep it off of television, and that film was not available until after 9/11. The video is Jihad in America. If you haven't seen it, you need to have. We have a supply. It took me almost 2.5 years to get a supply of them, but we have them. So give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and ask for Jihad in America. And then, of course, you really would, of course, want to get books that we have by Dr. Dennis Cuddy, September 11th, Prior Knowledge, his book on cover-up, and then certainly are some of our 4-tape sets going into what really happened that day. You should get our 4-tape sets on Oklahoma City, both the Oklahoma City and the Oklahoma City update. We have, of course, a great deal of history recorded here you're not going to find elsewhere, and it's all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a copy of our October newsletter, and of course that goes into the secret society that was created in the United States in 1640. And people say, 1640? How would you know about that? Well, we have books written by a Satanist who, of course, has studied this secret society. A book was written in 1926 by Manly Palmer Hall, one of the leading Satanists in America, and he tells you this. The book's The Secret Destiny of America. It is available through Radio Liberty. We do not have it in the catalog. You have to request it by name. The Secret Destiny of America, about the secret society that came to America in 1640. And what people have not understood is there have been two parallel forces in America, one the Christian, the other the satanic. And it wasn't until, of course, 1935, when, of course, they took the occult emblem that had been passed down for thousands of years, and, of course, was put on the back of the Great Seal of the United States, that it was put on the back of the dollar bill. The pyramid cap by the all-seeing eye, that isn't a Christian symbol. It is a Masonic symbol. It is an occult symbol. It's a Luciferian symbol. And, of course, Masonry was organized in 1717. This symbol goes back 6,000 years. So you need to understand what it's all about. I would be glad to send you a free copy of my newsletter if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. Listen to our programs 5 hours a day and not get much of anything accomplished. We're on shortwave, we're on internet, we're on satellite, we're on radio stations somewhere in America 5 hours a day. Tell others about our programs, encourage them to listen and to support our effort, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be with you once again. May the Lord be with you.